Harold Washington made history in 1983 when he was elected as Chicago's first African-American mayor. Now, a new biography out about him analyzes his legacy and asks if his progressive politics and race coalition building can be repeated again. Illinois State University history professor Roger Biles, the author of Mayor Harold Washington, champion of race and reform in Chicago, joins us. Plus, a new Illinois law regarding children in child seats, and researchers from Rush University Medical Center are hoping to find out why Latinos are at a much greater risk for developing Alzheimer's. And finally, it's been 75 years since the Rockford Peaches played their first game in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. We'll hear all about how Rockford celebrated.
We're the members of the All-American League. We come from cities near and far.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Hi there, I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's lots going on this hour on the 21st. Welcome. Up today, we're going to be talking about a new Illinois state law regarding children in car seats, and researchers from Rush University Medical Center are joining us to talk about a study that hopes to better understand why Latinos are at a such higher rate for developing Alzheimer's. Plus, remember A League of Their Own? It's actually been 75 years since the Rockford Peaches played their first game in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. We'll hear how Rockford celebrated. But first,
we are here to celebrate a resounding victory. We have fought a good fight. We have finished our course. And we have kept the faith. We fought that good fight. We fought it with unseasoned weapons and a phalanx of people who mostly had never been involved in a political campaign before. This has truly been a pilgrimage. Our government will be moving forward as well, including more people and more kinds of people than any government in the history of Chicago.
Thanks to WBEZ Chicago for that audio. I don't know if you recognize that voice, but that was Harold Washington, who made history in 1983 when he was elected as Chicago's first African-American mayor. Now, a new biography out about him just this week analyzes his legacy and asks if his progressive politics and race coalition building can be repeated again. It's called Mayor Harold Washington, Champion of Race and Reform in Chicago, and it's written by Roger Biles, an emeritus history professor at Illinois State University. He's going to be talking about his book this weekend at Printers Row Lit Fest in Chicago on Saturday at 2 o'clock. But right now, he joins us from our partner station WGLT in Bloomington. Roger, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Roger, I wondered if we could start with the story of Harold Washington. Did he intend to become Chicago's first black mayor?
Well, he was a person who grew up in politics. His father was very influential on the South Side, an important Democratic precinct captain, and Washington grew up in politics. And so I think he had probably been thinking about it for a long time. He was, as you may know, a state legislator in Illinois for many years, a member of the United States Congress. So he was a seasoned politician by the time the opportunity came around in 1983 for him to run for mayor. And so I think that was a long-term goal of his.
And certainly, as you mentioned, his time outside of Chicago, particularly in Springfield, he was a product of what we now call the Chicago machine. And it was fascinating to read to me how that machine reached to Springfield. Can you describe how that worked? When we talk about machine politics, in this case, you have some details in your book even of how lawmakers were directed to vote in Springfield and how that directive came down from Chicago and Mayor Daley.
Right. In those days, when Mayor Richard J. Daley was the head of the political machine, Democratic representatives from Chicago who went to Springfield were expected to represent the interests of Chicago and of the machine on a straightforward basis. And so each morning when they took their seat, they were given a sheet of paper that was called an idiot sheet, and they were told how to vote on each bill and every matter that was going to come up that day. And so they were not expected to question. They were simply given their marching orders. This is how you're going to vote. And for several years, Washington went along unquestioningly with those idiot sheets. But eventually, he began to chafe under that kind of restriction and began to push back against the machine.
And how did he do that?
Well, he did it very cautiously at first, but he started voting his conscience on a number of matters, so much so that Daley and others back in Chicago started to take notice of the independence of this Washington character, and they sent orders to him to get in line, and he didn't always do that, and sometimes that led to some real problems between Washington down in Springfield and the bosses back in Chicago.
Including voting for the Equal Rights Amendment.
He did. He voted for the Equal Rights Amendment at a time when the Democratic machine was not supporting that legislation. And he received a 100% rating from the National Organization for Women, the only Illinois legislator to get that kind of a rating. And that really set him at odds with some of his colleagues.
And it's amazing to think it was just last week, I don't know how many decades later, that the Equal Rights Amendment has now been passed by the Illinois State House. I guess maybe 40 years after Harold Washington originally voted for it. And that wasn't even the first vote, I imagine, right? Or there was a couple series of votes
right
during those times.
Right. And he voted for it each time.
I wonder if you can give us a sense of what Illinois politics was like in 1983. You're describing the machine. And actually, this was before 1983 when he was in Springfield. When we say that, what did that mean when we say the machine, they were handed, as you said, you have a great example of them being handed, as you said, idiot sheets. How did it work when you went against them?
Well, it was very difficult to go against it. For many, many years, the black population of Chicago supported the machine. There was an understanding there, what some people call plantation politics. And the understanding simply was that the black voters would turn out for the machine, and in return they would get certain perquisites. They would receive some money and some minor offices in City Hall and that sort of thing. It really wasn't much of a deal.
It looks like we're having some problems with our connection to Bloomington. You're listening to The 21st as we're talking to Illinois State University Emeritus History Professor Roger Biles. He's the author of a new book. It's actually out this week. It's called Mayor Harold Washington, Champion of Race and Reform in Chicago. We are having some technical difficulties. We apologize for that, but we are reaching out to Roger Biles. He's an emeritus history professor at Illinois State University. He has a new book that's out this week, and it's called Mayor Harold Washington, Champion of Race and Reform in Chicago. Let's hear a little more of Harold Washington, Chicago's first African-American mayor who made history in 1983 when he was first elected.
My transition team advises me that the city government is also in far worse financial condition than we thought. The city's general fund has a potential shortfall this year of as much as $150 million. To further complicate the matter, in the waning days of the outgoing administration, hundreds of new city jobs were passed out and hundreds of other jobs reassigned.
Washington, who made history in 1983 when he was elected as Chicago's first African-American mayor. Thanks to WBEZ Chicago for that audio. Let's hear a little bit more of Harold Washington when he was elected that night.
We are here to celebrate a resounding victory. We have fought a good fight. We have finished our course, and we have kept the faith. We fought that good fight. We fought it with unseasoned weapons and a phalanx of people who mostly had never been involved in a political campaign before. This has truly been a pilgrimage. Our government will be moving forward as well, including more people and more kinds of people than any government in the history of Chicago.
That's Harold Washington, the night that he was elected in 1983. We've been talking about his tenure with Roger Biles, an emeritus history professor at Illinois State University. Sorry for those technical difficulties. We do have Roger back with us from WGLT. Roger, thanks for being here. Sorry about that.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay, great. Roger, I wanted to ask you about what led to Harold Washington's election. Right before we got disconnected, you were talking about what politics was like, particularly among the African-American community in Chicago, and how much they played a role in being part of the machine. I wonder if we could fast forward to Mayor Daley's unexpected death and where that leaves different coalitions and opportunities for Mayor Harold Washington to run for office.
Right. Well, the demographics suggested that African Americans would play a pretty significant role in Chicago, but the problem was that they, of course, had been controlled by the political machine, and the demographics didn't reveal that a relatively small percentage of African Americans had registered to vote. So the big numbers didn't mean anything unless people were registered to vote and got out to vote. When Richard J. Daley died, he was replaced in office by a couple of other machine Democrats. And that led us to the 1983 election. And the key to Washington's victory was the tremendous voter registration effort that brought thousands and thousands of African Americans into the electorate for the first time.
And not just African Americans. I think there's been a lot that's been made of not just the African American, the Black, or the Brown coalition. People talk about the Black and Brown coalition that Harold Washington put together, him reaching out to the Latino community. How do you think that came about?
Well, it was a conscious effort on Washington's part. He talked a lot about putting together a rainbow coalition, and he talked about uniting the have-nots in Chicago. And so that meant for him not just Blacks, but Latinos, other people from different ethnic groups, the poor generally, gays and lesbians, and in the context of Chicago, the group known as Lakefront Liberals, that is whites who were left out of the political machine. And so he set about in 1983 to put together a coalition of all those groups. And that was part of the reason, of course, along with the tremendous Black turnout at the polls that resulted in his election in 1983.
And when we're thinking about the time, 1983, I wonder now in historical context, Harold Washington reaching out to all of those disparate groups. Now we think that's sort of just part of how the Democratic Party tends to work. At the time, was this pretty revolutionary?
It was. Lots of folks had talked about the importance of rainbow coalitions, but Washington's significance is that he made it work. He actually got tremendous numbers of people registered to vote for the first time. And he was able to get Blacks and Latinos to cooperate, whereas that had been very difficult to do previously.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Roger Biles. He's the author of Mayor Harold Washington, Champion of Race and Reform in Chicago. It's actually just out this week, and he's actually going to be speaking this weekend also in Chicago. If you're headed to Chicago, he's going to be at Printers Row Lit Fest on Saturday at 2 o'clock. When we come back from the break, we're going to continue this conversation about Harold Washington, in particular, how he reflects maybe the long civil rights movement and his other legacies. Stay tuned to the 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. My guest is Roger Biles. He's an emeritus history professor at Illinois State University. He's with us from our partner station WGLT in Bloomington. We're talking about his new book that's just out this week. It's called Mayor Harold Washington, Champion of Race and Reform in Chicago. Roger, what do you think Mayor Washington was able to accomplish during his one and kind of one and a half terms as Chicago mayor?
I think the traditional wisdom on that has been that he didn't accomplish all that much. And the explanation for that generally is what was called the council wars, whereby he had to struggle against an antagonistic city council for the better part of his first term, and that limited his ability to do some things. What I say in the book is that I think that despite that, he was able to get some things done. He was able to change the nature, the structure of Chicago government to a certain degree. He was able, for example, to issue several executive orders that provided access to government records. He instituted some affirmative action reforms that resulted in the hiring of minorities. And so I think he was able to do some substantive things in his short period in office. But, of course, the partisans of Washington are always saying if only Harold had lived, imagine what he could have done with more time.
And, of course, to your point, he died suddenly in office during his second term. There's a university professor that you have at the beginning of this book saying that one of the fundamental lessons he learned from Harold Washington in working under that administration was that when we're thinking, for example, about local economic development, race should be the first way that we should think about these planning problems. I wonder, when we think about the legacy of people who worked in the Washington administration, what that looks like.
Yes, the person you're referring to was someone who served in the Washington administration and really had never been in city government before. And so his comment was to the effect that he never realized how important race was in Chicago until he got in that position. And certainly it was terribly important that the election of 1983 and Washington's reelection in 1987 were largely fought out over the issue of race. The voting in those elections was pretty much straight along racial lines. And so you can't dismiss, I think, the importance of race. But at the same time, there's a quote from Washington in the 1983 election that I'd like to refer to. And the quote says, "This political battle is not about race. It is about money and power and morality." And Washington constantly tried to inform the people of Chicago that his interest was not just in elevating black people, but he was interested in reforming, truly reforming Chicago government and making it a government that was responsive to all people.
And in that, including in that responsiveness is kind of radical redistribution. Today we would say, certainly his calls for redistribution of wealth, I think, would be an interesting thing to hear someone say today. We heard some audio at the beginning of the show about that, referring to him talking about that. I wonder how you think Harold Washington tried to think about redistributing wealth and making Chicago a more equitable city.
Well, on one sort of basic level, he talked about the fact that services in the city had not been delivered equitably, literally for decades. When he became mayor, it was said there were people living on the South Side, African Americans living on the South Side, who saw dump trucks and city graders and snow plows for the first time, because those city machines had just never made it into their neighborhoods. So in part, it was about simply providing services to all people in all neighborhoods. That's a very basic thing, but, you know, in the day-to-day lives of people, it's very important.
And I wonder, as we look at Chicago today, how much of that legacy still remains when we think about Mayor Emanuel and what he's tried to do, the second Mayor Daley. Do you feel like some of that legacy has persisted?
Well, my personal view would be that regrettably not enough. I tend to see the second Mayor Daley and the Emanuel administrations as being a swerve back to business as usual to a great extent. And I think that those two mayors have undone, unfortunately, some of the reforms that Harold Washington was able to institute. But there's still some remnant of that, of the Washington years. And I think that people who live in Chicago and people who live in other places now can look back at the Washington administration, can look at the ideals expressed then, and can look at some of the reforms that were instituted then. And I think it can show them that these kinds of changes are possible, that they can't necessarily assume that it just happened one time, and that I think that can sort of buoy their spirits in a way.
And I guess that does lead us to the big question of this book. Do you think that Washington's years as mayors were an expression of progressive and coalition building politics that is unlikely to happen again?
I suppose that in talking with my colleagues, my academic colleagues, I suppose that's the prevailing assumption with a lot of folks, that the Washington administration was something of an aberration, and it's not likely to happen again, the pendulum seemingly having swung pretty far in the other direction. But I'm a little more hopeful than that, and I think that the pendulum can swing the other way, too, just as I think that the administration in Washington today, which has made a whole lot of folks unhappy, doesn't have to persist forever, and we can hold out hope that things are going to change.
I wonder, Roger, this book is about Chicago. You're based in Bloomington. Do you think that gave you a unique perspective in writing this?
Well, yes. And the fact that I used to live in Chicago, I've lived in Illinois most of my life. I'm pretty conversant with the way that Chicago politics and government operate, a little bit different, I would say, than the way they operate in Bloomington normal. But I do think my proximity to the city and my ability to get up there frequently, to get into the archives, to get into Harold Washington's papers and so forth, has definitely been important in the way that I've done the book.
That's Roger Biles. He is the author of Mayor Harold Washington, Champion of Race and Reform in Chicago. He's going to be speaking about this biography of Mayor Harold Washington this Saturday if you're in the Chicago area as part of Printers Row Lit Fest. But right now, I want to thank you for sharing a little bit about your book with us. Roger, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to keeping our kids safe, it's something we all take seriously, but sometimes guidelines are confusing. And whose recommendations do we follow, our doctors or the government? A new Illinois state law is hoping to make things a little simpler for parents, at least when it comes to children in car seats. it would require all children to be in rear-facing car seats until the age of 2. And as Senator Hastings of Tinley Park explained to the Associated Press, this would make the law a lot less vague and basically put into legislation the same guidelines that have been recommended for some time by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Joining me now from the Illinois chapter of the AAP is their Government Affairs Committee Chair, Eddie Pont. Hi, Eddie. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Eddie, my first question might be one that many listeners are wondering about when they hear about the new regulation, which is that children under 2 have to remain rear-facing. Are the guidelines regarding car seats, I think we tend to think of them more about a child's weight than age.
Yeah, and this was one of the reasons we decided to approach this issue. The current Illinois law is actually fairly, or well, it's currently law. The bill passed both houses, and we're very hopeful the governor will sign it. But right now, the Illinois law says only that a person transporting a child is responsible for properly securing the child in a, quote, appropriate child restraint system. And I know when I see parents in my office as part of the well visits we do, I'm always careful to say that they should be rear-facing until age 2. And so we saw this as an opportunity to clarify what the AAP guidelines, based on the most recent science, say, that any child up to 40 pounds under the age of two should be in a rear-facing car seat.
But for to your mind, what's more important, the age or the weight?
The age is important for a couple of reasons. First, most kids are nowhere near 40 pounds by the time they're 2. So most of the time, the weight doesn't come into play. But yes, if you have a child who's way at the top of the growth scale, it might. But by the age of 2, it is felt that the child has enough skeletal maturity that they'll be more resilient in a car crash. But I should point out that it says at least 2. If the child is over the age of 2 and is still comfortable rear-facing, it is perfectly appropriate to leave that child in the rear-facing position if the parent would like.
Dr. Pont, why is rear-facing safer?
Well, you know, the most concerning crashes are from the front. And if the energy is coming at the child and the child is in a front-facing, then there's really very little protection. You know, obviously, any car seat is better than not being restrained. You know, I wouldn't want people thinking, you know, that they shouldn't restrain them at all. But if the car seat is facing the rear, then the seat has the opportunity to absorb the vast majority of energy coming at the child. And, you know, studies show that rear-facing seats can reduce the risk of injury by 70 to 80% and the risk of death by almost 30% when compared to children of similar ages in seatbelts, for example.
And when we're thinking about the American Academy of Pediatrics, I imagine the reason that at a certain age rear-facing changes, is it just a logistical thing? As children get bigger, it makes sense to switch them around and have them facing front just because of their legs?
Well, not so much the legs, but the skeletal maturity. So the bones, at age 2, the bones are felt to be developed enough that they can assume the same amount of risk that you or I would assume, and it's appropriate to switch them to facing the front. But again, parents shouldn't, if they feel they'd prefer to keep their kids facing the rear, it's never wrong to have their kids facing the rear. It's just at age 2, you can flip them to the front.
My guest is Dr. Eddie Pont. He's chair of the Committee on Government Affairs with the Illinois chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Pont, how is this the standard then for this law that you all are hoping Governor Rauner will sign that has passed in both houses? Is this the standard across the country then?
Oh, yeah, this has been the standard for many years now. My parents are not surprised when I say rear-facing till age 2. They usually give me a smile and a nod and say, yes, Dr. Pont, we're doing it. This simply codifies in Illinois law what we hope, parents are doing in their cars with their toddlers to keep them as safe as possible.
And I wanted to ask you about, this might be a silly question, but I'm going to ask it on behalf of parents
okay.
who might be wondering.
I'll do my best.
What about parents who are worried that their kids are uncomfortable facing backwards, that they might get car sick, or that their legs might be kind of squinched up and not in a great position?
Yeah, no, it's not a silly question at all. I do get that question from time to time in my office. Well, what I usually tell the parents in my office is that even if the legs seem squished, it's still safer to face their kid to the rear. As far as nausea, we don't see that too much in the 0 to 2 population. You know, older kids obviously are a little more susceptible to it, but the 0 to 2-year-olds don't typically have too many problems along those lines. Every once in a while, though, to your point, we have a child who adamantly refuses to face the rear and really wants to look out the window that the mom and dad are looking out. Obviously, you know, it's hard to drive with a child who's screaming in the back, but most of the children, including my own daughter, for what it's worth, when she was this age, you eventually do make their peace with it. It is sometimes inconvenient, but the rear-facing option really is the best for children under the age of 2.
And the safest, it sounds like, as well. Do you think
Absolutely, this will be the safest.
Yeah. Do you think this will be a challenge to enforce?
No, I don't think so. I hope that the majority of parents already know what to do. We don't view this effort as, you know, punitive. I mean, we hope that it's more educational. I believe if a ticket is given, I don't know the specifics of what the fine would be. I believe it's called a petty misdemeanor, which is, you know, a very low level, I believe.
And my understanding is now it's an educational course that parents have to attend rather than a financial penalty under the current laws.
I believe there is that option, but I'd have to check that to be sure. But again, you know, our hope is that, you know, that this will just promote, you know, good, safe practice because, you know, the car is very convenient. We use them all the time, but there are dangers to it as well. And we just hope this is, you know, one less danger that parents that will be aware of. And then, you know, we'll help keep kids safe with it, which is what it's all about.
Dr. Pontes, the American Academy of Pediatrics have tips for parents who might find a challenge to afford a car seat, whether it's rear-facing or otherwise. Sometimes they can be quite expensive.
Well, you know, that's a good point. First, I would say there are convertible seats. So, you know, you can buy one seat that simply, you know, stays at the rear-facing position until age 2, and then you can flip it to the front-facing. Those cover children throughout the entire time that they need a car seat. I don't know of any programs offhand. I'm sure that cities and townships do have programs available if parents want to check those out and see if there is assistance. You know, I can say in my office, you know, we do see a fair number of people from modest backgrounds. They almost always do have a car seat. They are pretty readily available, I would think.
There's more information at IllinoisAAP.org on their website about this law, as well as about that whole issue of car seats and affordability as well. But right now, I want to thank Dr. Eddie Pont, who's chair of the Committee on Government Affairs for the Illinois chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Again, as soon as Governor Rauner signs it, assuming he signs this, will require all children to be in rear-facing car seats until the age of 2. Dr. Pont, thanks for being with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Aging and the health concerns that come with it is a health concern for all of us, and one of the largest concerns is Alzheimer's. Here in Illinois, the disease is the 6th leading cause of death, and more than 200,000 seniors live with the condition. And that statistic doesn't take into account those living with early onset Alzheimer's. And according to research from the University of Southern California, there's one population that's severely at risk, and that's the Latino community. Latinos are 50% more likely to develop the disease than white people. And by 2060, the number of Latinos living with Alzheimer's in the U.S. is expected to rise by 800%. There's a group of researchers in Illinois trying to understand and change that. On the line with us now is Dr. David Marquez. He's the lead investigator of the Latino Core Study at Rush University's Alzheimer's Disease Center. Dr. Marquez, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me and helping to spread this issue.
Dr. Marquez, I think the first big question, and I know this is what you were looking at for your study, is why do you think Latinos are at such a high risk for developing Alzheimer's?
Yes, that is the basis for the Latino core study. However, there have been studies done around the country, and one of the issues is that there are actually more older Latinos living in the United States than in the past. So there are more people that are in that pool. Additionally, the chronic diseases tend to be high among older Latinos, and there's some relationship between those chronic diseases and Alzheimer's disease, although we don't know exactly why yet. People of low income are more at risk for Alzheimer's disease, and unfortunately right now in the U.S., Latinos tend to be, in general as a whole, in the lower income population. So all of those play a role, but we do not know exactly why.
For people who are already living with this, I also wonder what role language and culture plays in getting diagnosed or seeking treatment.
That's a great point. One of the issues of monolingual Spanish speakers is there a neurologist or is there a provider who will be able to understand the person not only in language, which was a huge barrier for many, but culturally as well, to understand how the family is feeling about it, how the person feels about it. And the number of providers across the United States, even in major urban areas like Chicago, are low.
To that point, Dr. Marquez, we're speaking with Dr. David Marquez, who's the lead investigator of the Latino Core Study at Rush University's Medical Center, Rush's Alzheimer's Disease Center. What are you trying to learn in this study?
Well, we are recruiting Latinos 65 and older who do not currently have a diagnosis of dementia. And so by doing this, we can conduct testing annually. And upon death, we are requesting brain donation, although it's not mandatory to be in the study. And so because we will have this annual data, and unfortunately some of the people in the study are likely to develop Alzheimer's disease, we hopefully are able to see what are those things, what are those factors that might put older Latinos more at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And on the contrary, what are those things that might protect older Latinos from developing the disease? So in this way, starting with people who do not already have the disease, we can examine those factors over time.
And what kind of research are you doing for people who are in this study? Does this involve a meeting with different investigators?
Yes. So we try to make it with as little burden as possible for the participants. So at the Rush Alzheimer's Disease Center, we're sure to provide information and education first. So we recruit people a lot of times through presentations that we give on what is Alzheimer's disease, how is it related to things like exercise and diabetes and things like that. And then we if they are interested, they let us know, and then we call them, go through a quick information session. Then what's important is we do everything within their home. So we send the project coordinator will go to the home to do informed consent. The blood draw, the data collection, all of that takes place in their home. And then I will go, once we have results, to follow up with them and to talk about any concerns that they might have.
And so it sounds like you're still looking for people to participate in this study. Is this mostly for people in the Chicago area only?
Yes, it is in the Chicago area, not necessarily Chicago proper. We do go out to suburbs, and we do go to the northwest part of Indiana because the trip is not too far. We are still recruiting. We have about almost 200 people enrolled in the study right now and are hoping to get our numbers up to 300.
Dr. Marquez, you mentioned one thing, which is that one thing you've asked people for, and you said it wasn't required, was that once they die, that they can donate their brain to you. I wonder, is it difficult to talk to families about that, or is that something, have you found that to be a tough ask?
In general, yes, that can be a difficult conversation because the person is in front of you is alive and well, and you're talking about death. And sometimes that's a little bit harder to talk about with the Latino community. However, what we find is that so many people in our studies have loved ones who have been affected by this disease, and they have seen it through their parents, their aunts, their uncles. And so they say, you know what, I want to be a part of the solution. I want to help scientists learn more so that my kids or my grandkids, future generations, do not have to go through this disease.
I wanted to ask you one last question, Dr. Marquez. While we have you here, you mentioned a presentation that you make to folks. What are some common misconceptions you think people have about Alzheimer's in general?
Number one, I would say, is that people think that, well, this is just a part of aging. And that, as we get older, we forget things, and it can just turn into Alzheimer's disease. And that's really a misconception, because it is true that as we get older, our memory decreases a bit. But Alzheimer's, it is a disease, and so it's manifesting itself in the brain that causes changes that aren't typically going to happen. And so it's trying to inform people about that so that they're aware if they see changes going on. Might it be something to have checked out, or is it something that might be expected?
That's Dr. David Marquez from Rush University Medical Center. He's the lead investigator of this Latino core study we have been learning about. We'll have more information about this at our website. But Dr. Marquez, thank you for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you again for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris.
That, of course, is a clip of Tom Hanks playing the coach Jimmy Dugan in the 1992 film A League of Their Own. 75 years ago, in May 1943, the team that film is based on, the Rockford Peaches, played their first game in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. To celebrate that anniversary, the International Women's Baseball Center has been hosting a variety of events, including a Diamonds, Denim, and Stars fundraiser, autograph signings with the original Peaches, Rockford Peaches Day at the City Market, and more. Joining me now is Kat Williams. She's president of the International Women's Baseball Center, and she just got back from Rockford. She's on the line now from Huntington, West Virginia, where she's also a professor of women's sport history at Marshall University. Hi, Kat. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Kat, I wonder if you can tell us some of your favorite events that happened in the 75th anniversary celebration of the Rockford Peaches.
Wow. Finding a favorite would be hard. All of them were incredibly successful. I would have to say the event on Wednesday night, May 30th, at the Coronado Theater was just unbelievable for so many reasons. First of all, that theater is fabulous. And we had there to help celebrate the 75th anniversary. We had Kim Ng, who is the senior vice president of Major League Baseball, the highest ranking female in Major League Baseball. We had former ball players. We had current ball players. We had state and local politicians. And we had the Women's Baseball World Cup trophy tour kicked off in Rockford. So all of that was a celebration for the 75th anniversary, but it was also about looking to the future of women's baseball. So I would have to say that was just one of the most amazing experiences that we've had.
Before we get to the future, let's start in the past. And I just wanted to ask you about the original Rockford Peaches we were talking about. This is the early 1940s, right? How did the league get started? Right. Were the Rockford Peaches one of the early teams?
Yes, and in fact, in 1943, Philip Wrigley, who was, of course, connected to the Chicago Cubs and the chewing gum company put together at first it was the All-American Girls Softball League in 1943. And as many people know from the movie A League of Their Own, that comes from the fact that most of the men were at war. And there was a huge interest in softball in the Midwest at the time. And in fact, in 1939, softball outdrew in fans all of minor league baseball in the Midwest. And so Wrigley had the idea that, hey, this is a way to get some ball games going in some of those local parks, give people some well-deserved and well-timed entertainment because of the war. So he and some of the other owners started the All-American Girls League, and then very quickly realized that these women were amazing ball players. And so the league lasted until 1954. The Rockford Peaches was one of the original four teams.
And when we think about what the International Women's Baseball Center does, as part of what you do is preserve the history of this groundbreaking league and women's baseball in general. As you mentioned, mm-hmm. the future of it, I wonder what the state of women's baseball is now. I think a lot of people associate softball with young girls and women, but right. women's baseball is an entirely separate thing.
It is. And the International Women's Baseball Center is certainly about preserving the history and the legacy of all women and girls baseball internationally. And by that, I also mean players, umpires, owners, coaches, stat keepers, everybody that's been involved in baseball internationally, because women always have been involved in baseball. Since there's been baseball, women have been part of it. Well, the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League is an incredibly important part of that history. It's only one piece of that history. And so what we at the IWBC want to do and are doing is we will continue to preserve the history and the legacy of that league. And we're talking about that league right now because of this 75th anniversary. But we want to use that history as a way to help to create opportunities for girls and women in baseball today. It's about using sport for empowering girls. And for example, the IWBC co-sponsors the Baseball for All Girls National Tournament in Rockford. We did so last year. There were over 270 girls in Rockford for the largest girls national tournament. We are bringing it back to Rockford this year and is already bigger. There are a lot of girls and women around this country playing baseball. And in fact, starting in a couple of days, women will be trying out for the USA women's baseball team, which will of course participate in the Women's Baseball World Cup being played in August for the first time on American soil.
Wow. So the legacy of the Rockford Peaches lives on. I want to thank Kat Williams for being with us, president of the International Women's Baseball Center. Kat, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're going to be hearing from the folks at ProPublica Illinois about a new project they've been working on trying to document hate crimes. They need your help for that, so stay tuned into tomorrow's program for that. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. It's a pretty easy app to download. If you look for it, you set your home station, and then that's how you can find us. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow. I'm Nyla Boodoo.